Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Preston Connor, and I will be your host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute of Politics was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 55 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website at www.hinckley.utah.edu for more information. The Hinckley Institute of Politics proudly presents the 17th annual Rocco C. and Marion S. Siciliano Forum. This year's theme is the future of U.S.-Latin American relations. This is one of 21 events that will extend through next Monday. For a listing of all the events, we encourage you to pick up a brochure in the back of the room. The title of today's forum is A Long 90 Miles, Reality of Cuban Détente. Our guest is Rachel DeLevy-Ore, an assistant director with the Atlantic Council's Adrian Arsht Latin American Center. Her work focuses on U.S.-Cuban relations, Mexican reform, and the role of technology in elections. Rachel was a key player in the creation, execution, and dissemination of the first-ever national poll on American public opinion of U.S.-Cuba policy, a study which has since been cited in media outlets across the world as an important influence in the policy discussion. Rachel has worked to position the Latin American Center as a key voice on the normalization of the U.S.-Cuba relationship, with an eye towards how a renewed rapport with Cuba will improve the United States' relationship with the rest of Latin America. Rachel spent the early part of 2014 traveling throughout the United States to promote the findings of the Cuban policy public opinion poll and engage with the breadth of stakeholders. Later, she spearheaded an Atlantic Council research trip to Cuba, where members met with economists, artists, dissidents, and government officials to further inform the Latin American Center's work on Cuba. Such work has included op-eds, memos, public events on the changing dynamics of the U.S.-Cuba relationship. The Latin American Center works to study, educate, and strengthen the trends of transforming Latin America into a strong Western partner. Rachel has been part of briefings for the State Department, the National Security Council, and members of Congress on issues including U.S.-Cuba policy, Mexican energy reform, and the Colombian peace talks. The Latin American Center has also made Mexican energy reform a key tenet of its work as an example of economic transformation in the hemisphere. Rachel was a part of the team that published a series of reports tracking the progress of the reform and helped to create the public events and media strategy used to promote that research. Previously, Rachel worked for Grunewald Communications, a political communications firm in Washington, D.C. The firm creates TV and radio ads for Democratic candidates. And Rachel's campaigns include Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren and Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin. Interviewing her today will be Claudio Holzner. He's a professor of political science and associate director for the University Center for Latin American Studies. Help me welcome them here today.
So my role today will be to facilitate the discussion with Rachel on this really momentous change in U.S.-Cuba relations. I'll be asking her a series of questions. And when I'm done with my set of questions, we're going to open it up to the audience for questions from you about this new policy shift. So on December 17th, President Obama radically changed U.S. policies towards Cuba, reestablishing diplomatic relationships and easing travel restrictions to the island. As we speak, the second round of talks have begun in Washington, D.C., with a delegation from Cuba coming to the U.S. So a lot has changed. Arguably nothing in U.S.-Latin America relations has changed as quickly and as dramatically as the relationships between the U.S. and Cuba. So can you give us a little bit of an insight as to what's changed, what's happened, and what some of the most important implications might be?
Yeah, definitely. Well, first of all, thank you so much for doing this with me this morning. Big thank you to Kirk Jowers for bringing me out here. It's very exciting to see this renewed interest in Latin America, both in Washington but also across the country. So I'm very excited to see this kind of engagement. So the president did a lot of things, a lot of technical changes that I'll talk about later. But I think the big thing to understand about what the president did is that he fundamentally changed the way the United States approaches the its policy towards Cuba. So for 50 years, the United States had a policy of regime change in Cuba. It was hoping to use the embargo to strangle Cuba into democracy. Didn't work. Not only is Cuba still a communist country, they've got the same guys running the show. The Castros are now living through their 11th American president. And so when President Obama reestablished diplomatic relations, he officially recognized the Castros as the leaders of Cuba. America's going to send an American ambassador to Havana who will present credentials to Raul Castro as the president of Cuba. That's a huge philosophical, fundamental shift in the way the United States is going to engage with Cuba going forward. So that's sort of the umbrella thing to understand, and then we can look at the more technical changes. The restoration of diplomatic relations means we'll be opening an embassy in Cuba. It means we'll hopefully be sending an ambassador. And there's also been major changes to the travel policy. So now all kinds of purposeful travel fall under a general license. Purposeful travel is for religious purposes, education, research, humanitarian, but it doesn't include tourism. So don't pack your bathing suit yet. I can go down to Cuba and conduct research and meet with dissidents and artists and people from the medical community, but I can't go lie on the beach. That is something only Congress can allow you to do.
Okay. So the countries haven't really spoken officially, right, to each other for 50 years, and there were a lot of expectations about this first round of talks between the two countries, a lot of hope that they would go really well, but in fact they were difficult in many ways, and there's lack of trust between the two countries. So tell us a little bit about how the meetings have gone and what you expect will happen in this next round.
Yeah, I think very early on we saw a lot of reason for optimism. So one of the things that the president announced on December 17th was that the Cubans would be releasing 53 political prisoners. They did that a lot faster than anyone anticipated they would. So it showed some serious commitment to advancing the relationship. Since then, we've seen the Cubans dragging their feet a lot. The first round of talks that happened in Havana at the end of January were a lot about the conditions under which the embassies would open, and the Cubans started making demands that they knew would never be met, such as American diplomats won't be allowed to meet with Cuban dissidents. That's never going to fly. They know that. So this is them dragging their feet a little, and that's very interesting to see because for 50 years, the United States refused to come to the negotiating table, refused to sit down and talk to Cuba. And Cuba actually looked like the more reasonable party in this by being willing to engage with the United States, saying, we'll talk when you want to talk. Now the United States has come to the table, and Cuba's not so sure that they want all these changes happening so quickly. The Cubans want this to happen slowly, methodically. They want to be able to take the temperature on the island of how these changes are impacting the people, because they want some of these changes, but they definitely don't want a change in power structure. And so I've spoken with several of the American government representatives who are involved in these negotiations, and they told me that the Americans are trying to implement change as quickly and chaotically as possible because they think that's the best way that they'll be able to affect a sort of disruptive force within Cuba. So it's really interesting to see that shift in dynamic there. And it's really where we see the eternal tension in Cuba. On the one hand, it's the mission statement of Cuba to end the embargo with the United States and to be able to prosper as a country. And on the other hand, the embargo has been the gift of a lifetime for the Castros. All of the woes of Cuba can be blamed on the big, bad embargo. And the Castros have masterfully crafted this rhetoric around that. And if they don't have that as a rallying cry anymore, that's a big threat to them. So it'll be very interesting to see how the Cubans play this one out. I will say I think that there's reason for optimism when we look at the fact that the second round of talks is happening just a month after the first one. I think that both sides are going to be really serious about moving ahead. The U.S. wants to show up at the Summit of the Americas in April and say, see, we're making progress. And Cuba definitely doesn't want to look like it's backpedaling.
Right. So you described this policy shift as a major philosophical change in the way the U.S. government approaches Cuba. Why now? Why is the U.S. making this philosophical shift now? Most people expected that to happen that happened after Raul and Fidel died and passed off the scene. So why have all these policy changes happened now?
Well, there's a couple forces within the United States that made this happen, and there's a couple forces within Cuba that made this happen. In the United States, there's majority support from the American people, and the president needed a win. In Cuba, Venezuela, its biggest benefactor, is having a rough time, to say the least. And so if you look at the American side, you know, the Atlantic Council did this poll, this public opinion poll of Americans last year, asked them, are you in favor of normalizing relations with Cuba? And what was interesting about that poll is we weren't just asking people in Miami. We weren't just asking Cuban Americans. We asked all Americans. We asked Americans in Utah and New York and Texas and California. And what we found is that across the political spectrum, most people favor normalization. But the most interesting thing that came out of that is that the state that most favors normalization is Florida. So that just completely destroys this conventional wisdom that Florida is the reason that we still have the embargo. And it's only ever been a national issue because of Florida. If you look at the three largest states according to the Electoral College, you've got Texas, pretty comfortably Republican. You've got California, pretty comfortably Democratic. And then there's Florida, which is basically your only swing state. And it used to be that you couldn't win Florida without singing the praises of the embargo. And that's no longer true. So it doesn't hold the political juice that it once did. And then President Obama needed a legacy issue. He's not winning on ISIS, Ukraine, Ebola. I mean, this man has been besieged by crisis. And make no mistake, when the history books are written, Nixon will have opened relations with China and Obama will have opened relations with Cuba. So that's the American side. And then from the Cuban perspective, if you will indulge me in a sports metaphor for a moment.
I love sports.
Unlike the rest of soccer-crazed Latin America, Cubans love baseball. And they know it's three strikes, you're out. First strike was when the U.S. cut off relations. Second strike was the fall of the Soviet Union. And they see the third strike coming, and they're not going to let it happen. And that's Venezuela. Venezuela pours millions of barrels of oil into Cuba each year, and it's undergoing huge political turmoil right now. They're grappling with the falling price of oil. Cuba sees the writing on the wall. They don't want a third strike. And so they needed to look for other resources to support themselves. And then the other thing that both countries had to keep in mind is the Summit of the Americas, which is this gathering of the heads of state of the Americas. It's happening in April. And for the past 20 years, Cuba hasn't been invited at the request of the United States. And this year, Panama, the host country, said, Cuba's invited and the U.S. can come or not. So it was really in the interest of both countries to progress in the relationship or else make the rest of the Americas sit through a very awkward dinner party come April.
Right. So let's go into a little bit more depth about some of the specific policy changes and how this will impact both American businesses, American people, and the Cuban people as well. So trade is still pretty heavily restricted under Helms-Burton, right?
Yeah.
Not everything is changing. Not everything is opening up. But there are opportunities for new trade relationships. Where will we see the biggest opportunities for American companies?
So agriculture and medicine have always had a foot in the door in that way of having a sort of humanitarian provision. They will still have expanded access in that way. The U.S. is the fourth largest food provider for Cuba and the third largest pharmaceutical provider already. So I think we will see that expand. As for regular consumer goods, I wouldn't get terribly excited. Just because you can trade with a country doesn't mean it's a great idea. You don't see a booming private sector from Europe in Cuba, and they've been allowed to be there for decades. Last week, the Atlantic Council had a call with Christian Leffler, who's the managing director of the Americas for the EU. And he's been the chief negotiator in the EU-Cuba talks that opened last year. And also Arnaldo Abruzzini, who is the secretary general of the largest chambers of commerce in Europe. And so we have this leading voice in the private sector, this leading voice in the political sector, both who have been very involved in the negotiations with Cuba. It was a pretty grim conversation. Arnaldo made some really interesting points about why it's not a tempting business environment is the huge lack of legal assurances. there's nothing really to say that the Cuban government will just seize all of your assets. And if there's some kind of dispute, there's no real competent judicial system to deal with this. So it's not that tempting. I mean, the European Union, Cuba only makes up 0.1% of the European Union's trade. I'm not sure why it would be terribly different for the United States. I think if there is an industry that would get in the door, it would be tourism. They would sort of be able to navigate this a little better because there are such big opportunities, but they can't yet because of the embargo. That is really going to need to be opened by Congress. So overall, I find the business argument a little overrated. This is a country of really weak purchasing power. This is a country of weak legal assurances. This is a country that has really high cost of operations, super expensive electricity, really poor infrastructure. You don't need to be the Secretary General of the Chamber of Commerce to know that this is not an enticing offer.
But what about the telecommunications industry? So some of the articles that I've read, this has been one of the issues that is, in fact, on the table, right? To allow the Cubans to purchase more telecommunications equipment, to beef up their internet capacity. Cuba's a pretty closed-off country, right? And so would this have an impact on Cuba's economy, on Cuba's politics?
Yeah. So if I sing a really pessimistic tune on business in general, I sing a much more hopeful tune on this one because this could be really huge for Cuba. Cuba really likes to think of itself as a pretty advanced country, the likes of Mexico and Brazil. And, you know, when I was in Havana, I talked to a lot of people who were rightfully very proud of the biotechnology industry there. Cuba exports biotech all over the world. I mean, it's really valuable. This is a country that supports the lowest infant mortality rate in all of the Americas. That's including Canada and the U.S. But those same doctors cannot reliably send an email. This is a country with 5% internet penetration rate. You know where else has that? Bhutan. So this is very, very low. And, you know, when I was there in Havana last June and I had dinner with a reporter from Reuters, and he told me, I will never complain about my Verizon bill again, because he told me that his monthly internet bill is $860 a month. So that's staggering to me. I'm sure that's staggering to you. And then you contextualize that in the fact that the average monthly salary in Cuba is $25 a month. I mean, to say that this is prohibitively expensive is an understatement. And telephony is really not any better. It's super expensive. Most countries have a one-to-one ratio of incoming and outgoing calls. Cuba receives 10 times as many calls as it puts out because it's so expensive. And so, yes, it would be a huge difference. Look, Netflix came into Cuba last week. And people are very excited about this. And I'm very excited about this for the symbolism of it, because it's great that something so commercial and so mainstream showed up in Cuba so quickly after this announcement. But it's symbolism, because let's remember, we're talking about 5% of the population having access to internet. And that's mostly dial-up. Now, I don't know how many of you have tried to stream something on dial-up, but it's really not a relaxing way to binge-watch House of Cards. So that's not great. So if telecom is able to expand in this country, that's going to have a huge effect. But let's remember that this is as much a policy question as a technical question for the Cuban government. So I am cautiously optimistic.
Right. So one of the things that I'm hearing is that there are a lot of structural obstacles in Cuba's economy. And you mentioned property rights being an important one. Trusting that the Cuban government will see through the policies respecting property rights. Cuba also has a dual currency, right? A dollar-pegged currency and a currency that's used by most Cubans.
Yep.
And they also don't have much access to international financial institutions. They don't have access to credit that will allow them to invest in business opportunities. Can you tell us a little bit more about the dual currency and some of the other issues that Cuba faces?
Yeah, definitely. This is a huge obstacle for the country that will actually really need the support of the international community and won't fall exclusively on the U.S. as the sole responsibility of the U.S. to move forward on this. So like you said, Cuba has a dual currency system. This is not a black market and a legitimate. There's actually two legal currencies in Cuba. It's pretty crazy. And so one's pegged to the dollar, and only 5% of the population has access to it. It's definitely the better currency. And 95% of the country has the other kind. And so I was speaking to an ambassador from a European country in Havana, and he was saying that there's this special economic zone that's been built in Cuba that's tried to attract foreign investment. And it's just crazy. When you go there, if you operate in this port, you have to pay the government in one currency and you have to pay your laborers in another. And it's just such a mess. It's just not going to be attractive to foreign investment. And Cuba really needs the influx of foreign capital to be able to develop. And they know that they need to unify their currency. They just don't know how. And that's why access to the international financial institutions is really important. International financial institutions are the IMF, they're the World Bank, they're the regional banks. I know everyone loves to hate the IMF, but they have their purpose. And so if you look at Albania or Myanmar, which were countries that were completely cut off from the international system for years, the IMF really shepherded them through this process of coming back into the fold. And Cuba needs that kind of support. Right now, Cuba doesn't have access to that because it's on what's called the U.S. State Sponsors of Terrorism list. We can talk about that a little more in depth later. But as a result of being on that list, as a consequence of that, it doesn't have access to these institutions. Now, the president has called for a review of Cuba's status on that list. I think they'll be off by the end of 2015, and that will be really important for the development of the country.
So it sounds like Cuba is potentially, right, there's a lot that needs to happen still, but it's potentially on the cusp of some major transformations, right, particularly economic transformations, which will have an impact on U.S. businesses, potentially an impact on businesses in Cuba. But what about ordinary Cubans, right? So one of the selling points of these policies is that they will benefit ordinary Cubans. What do you think the impact will be of these political and economic changes?
So when it comes to how ordinary Cubans benefit economically, we have to look to this really small but growing private sector in Cuba. So there's this class called the cuenta propistas, which is these people who have started small businesses. By small businesses, I mean nail salons, ice cream parlors, plumbers, people renting out a room or two in their homes. I mean, this is not corporations. And it used to be that this didn't happen at all in Cuba. These only started being legal about 3 years ago. The Castro started issuing licenses to a few select industries. They did not do this out of the goodness of their hearts. They had to take 500,000 people off the Cuban government payroll. Half a million people is a lot, but it's really a lot when your whole country is 11 million people. And so they needed to somehow find a way to employ these 500,000 people, and so they started issuing these licenses, and people started opening these small businesses, and it's kind of amazing because we're talking about 3 and 4 generations of people who have never seen a private sector, who never lived with a private sector. They have nothing to emulate. And so one of the most interesting things that I saw when I was in Havana was this program called Cuba Emprende, which is run out of the Catholic Church, actually. And it's this 2-week training course on the basics of running a business. It's 3 days on marketing and 3 days on finance and 3 days on HR for people who are opening a nail salon, just to have sort of a basic run through of what it means to run a business. And so that private sector is going to support the Cuban people, and the way that the change in American policy supports that is that the amount of money that Americans are able to send back to Cuba has been increased. So, you know, new businesses need an influx of capital. That's not coming from anywhere in Cuba. That's coming from Aunt Mimi in Miami. And now Aunt Mimi can send a lot more than she used to be able to. So that's going to be a positive flow of capital for the private sector in Cuba.
Okay. Now, these policies have not been uncontroversial, right? I mean, you're painting a very pretty picture here, right? But historically, there's been staunch opposition against, particularly from Florida and from the Republican Party, against opening up relationships with Cuba. And still to this day, prominent senators and congressmen argue that the U.S. should not be trading with an authoritarian regime, right? that these increasing economic relationships only strengthen the communist government in Cuba. What do you make of these critiques of Obama's policy?
I would love for us to never trade with an evil regime. That sounds great. So we'll never buy another drop of oil from Saudi Arabia or Nigeria ever again. And we will shut down Visa and MasterCard in Russia. And Apple will shut down all of its operations in China. This is not a, this is not a viable option. And I think the important thing to understand about bringing more Americans to Cuba through travel, through expanded access to information, through the telecommunications industry, is that Cubans are so closed off from the rest of the world that the only source of money and power and information that they have ever seen is the Cuban government. And now that might start changing. And so, yeah, maybe there's going to be something that's a little bit good for the Castros, but if we're talking about better roads and better homes and a stronger private sector and better access to information for the rest of Cuba, that seems like a pretty good trade-off to me.
Okay. Now, another issue is that, and you mentioned this briefly, is that Cuba is currently on the U.S.'s list of state sponsors of terrorism, right? And national security issues are foremost in the minds of many Americans and in the minds of many policymakers. Is there any security downside to taking Cuba off of this list?
On the contrary, I think it is a security issue that they remain on this list. I think we should take a look at who's on the list, who's not on the list. Who's on the list? Syria, Sudan, Iran, Cuba. Anyone who read the newspaper this morning or any morning of the last 5 years knows that there is something seriously wrong with that list. Who's not on it? Yemen, North Korea, Libya, where 21 people were just beheaded. Russia, which has invaded a sovereign nation, giving Europe its biggest scare since the world wars. I mean, this list has got to regain some legitimacy. Yes, the Castros are dictators, like the Vietnamese are authoritarian, but they're not Bashar al-Assad. They're not Ayatollah Khomeini. So for me, the biggest national security issue is making sure that we have Latin America and the rest of Latin America on the same page as us, on our team. And so we've got to clean up our relationship with the rest of Latin America and make sure that we are all advocating for the same thing. And this change in policy really moves us that much closer towards it. If you want to talk about national security, let's talk about the fact that Cuba's biggest benefactors are Russia, China, and Venezuela. China's pouring in investment, Venezuela's pouring in oil, Russia just forgave $32 billion in debt. I mean, this is happening 90 miles away from us, and we're not going to be there. That, to me, that's a national security problem.
So the president has done a lot recently, right? But he's pretty much exhausted his executive capacity to change relationships further, which leaves most of the rest of the work in the hands of Congress, right? If more changes are going to happen, if the embargo is to be fully lifted, Congress has to take action. Do you expect Congress to take any further action in this session or in the near future to either ease restrictions further or to reaffirm the embargo?
Well, it's very unpopular to be optimistic about Congress.
And you're from D.C.
And even perhaps even most in D.C., and yet I am. I think that we've seen some really interesting people come out in favor of changing policy. There's a really strong libertarian argument to be made for changing policy that we've seen a lot of Republicans talking about, which is saying this is the United States unnecessarily restricting Americans' freedom of movement, freedom of commerce. I think that's a really strong philosophical argument that a lot of people can really buy into. And there's going to be legislation put forth. And that legislation is probably not going to be to lift the embargo whole hog, but more chipping away at it. So to lift the travel ban, to ease trade restrictions. I think we're going to see that legislation show up in the next couple of weeks, actually. Mm-hmm. So this is pretty soon. And legislation means votes. So mostly we don't know what most of our elected officials think about Cuba. Mostly people have never had to throw their hat in the ring. And this is going to be an opportunity for people to really take a stand on this. And I, I am hopeful. I am optimistic. And the other thing is, I think there's some not so obvious voices on this, some not so obvious opinions. Everyone expects Marco Rubio to be, you know, right out front, really fiery, in favor of the embargo, anti-new policy. But he's starting to be more of a national political figure now than just in Florida. And now that it's lost its juice on the national level, he may not be quite as ferocious as everyone expects. And then the most important senator in this entire conversation is now Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee, the new chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. And no one knows what he thinks. He hasn't said anything. And there's no such thing as party loyalty anymore, because on the one hand, he's got Marco Rubio. And on the other, he's got Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona, who's a Republican, who's long been in favor of lifting the embargo, and he specifically comes at this from wanting to lift the travel ban. He has this great line, which is, I think that we should just unleash spring break onto Havana, and the Castros will be waving the white flag of surrender by the end of the week. It's a really brilliant line, because it's very funny, but it's very poignant, and it reminds us that we are our own best ambassadors.
So you think the Republican Congress is going to throw Obama a win then? We'll see. I mean, it's going to come. It's
not happily, but I think we may see the end of the travel ban by 2015, so maybe start looking for that bathing suit.
Okay. So I'm a Latin Americanist, and you work for a center that focuses on Latin America as well, so you don't come at these issues just from a domestic policy perspective. Yeah. And you've mentioned sort of briefly that Latin America is looking closely at what the U.S. is doing, and is somehow, I don't know, baiting the U.S. a little bit into making a policy switch. So, talk a little bit about how this shift in policy is important to our allies in Latin America and Europe, perhaps.
Yeah, definitely. No, I mean, like you said, you're a Latin Americanist and I'm a Latin Americanist. I definitely look at this way beyond the bilateral relationship, but rather to understand the implications for the region, the U.S. relationship with the region. So if you're here today, if you are a student of Latin American studies, if you're paying attention to Latin America at all, you know that in the last 10, 15, 20 years, it's undergone a profound transformation. I mean, this is a region that has thriving democracies and free elections and freedom of press, and I know it's a little ironic that I'm saying that. I'm also talking about Cuba, which is kind of the last holdout in this regard, but most of the region is a region of Westerners, and you don't need to explain the importance of these freedoms to them. And so we have these really serious, important allies in Colombia and Mexico who were saying, we want to be on the same team, but we just cannot support this antiquated policy one day more. We got that message really loud and clear when Panama said, Cuba's coming, you can come or not. I mean, the U.S. needs to be involved in its own regional politics, so that's really important that it's changing that dynamic, and it's changed that dynamic in two really important ways. The first is it restores some legitimacy to the United States when the U.S. talks about Cuba. Shows that the U.S. is serious about being proactive in engaging with Cuba. And the second thing it does, and I think this is the absolute most important thing that's come out of this change in policy, is that it takes the United States out of the conversation. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about Cuba, we talk about Cuba. It used to be that when you were in Argentina or France or Japan and you talked about Cuba, you had to talk about the embargo. That's not true anymore. When we talk about Cuba, we can talk about supporting civil society. We can talk about the fact that Cuba has a 100% literacy rate. Let's not throw out the baby with the bathwater here. There's some really smart and educated people in this country. We can talk about supporting economic reforms. We can talk about investment. We don't have to talk about the United States anymore, and it's such a relief, and that's so positive for the future of the relationship of the United States with Latin America. I mean, you've seen our Latin American allies singing Obama's praises, but perhaps most interesting has been to see the response of the anti-American left in Latin America, who love to rip apart the U.S. President Maduro of Venezuela, whose full-time job is to bash the United States, had nothing left to say except for to call President Obama's actions a noble act. I mean, that is truly something to hear from him. So, you know, we have this pro-embargo lobby in the United States that is getting much smaller, but it's still quite noisy. And they've said that this is Obama giving in to the Castros. They're just wrong in that way. What this has done is take the United States out of the conversation and let the international community focus on supporting a democratic and free Cuba. And isn't that the whole point?
Well, I think that's really interesting. It's not just supporting a democratic and free Cuba, but also it frees up potentially Latin American countries, which, as you mentioned, are now, for the most part, democratic themselves, and there's a very strong democratic culture in Latin America. It frees up these countries to persuade Cuba to implement political openings in ways that the U.S. never had the clout to do. And so it may actually promote democracy in Mexico, in Cuba, in ways that the embargo never did.
Absolutely, I completely agree with that. I think we now have allies in this mm-hmm. issue in a way that we didn't before, and that was so crazy because we line up on, you know, pretty much everything else with countries like Brazil and Chile, and, you know, in believing in freedom of assembly and protest and freedom of press, and yet we couldn't be on the same page as them because of this policy, right. And now we can, and that's right. Really valuable.
That's great. Well, this has been really interesting. I have more questions, but I'm sure you all have some questions for Rachel as well. So what I'd like to do right now is open up the floor to for Q&A with Rachel from the audience. And I'll let you moderate and pass out the microphone as you see fit.
Thanks. And please state your name and maybe a little something about you as you ask a question.
My name is Martha, and I'm studying social work. We are having a presentation about Cuba, NGOs, though.
Oh.
But it was so hard for us to find actually NGOs that were not, they didn't have to go through the government's mm-hmm. approval, so yeah. They're non-governmental mm-hmm. organizations. So in your experience, do you think that would change soon? And have you known of any NGO that's been successful helping Cubans?
Yeah. It's really interesting you ask that because I was just at a meeting a few days ago about the Summit of the Americas, and they're developing this whole civil society forum, and you have to apply online to be a participant in this. And one of the things that they're doing is with an eye towards Cuba and Venezuela specifically, sorting out, and I loved this term, I'd never heard it before, gongos, which are government-organized non-governmental organizations, and sort of these, you know, not real NGOs. And so there's this really aggressive, there's this application process, and there's this really aggressive effort on the behalf of the OAS to sort through these groups and to see who's really an NGO and who's maybe a little too heavily funded by the Castros. And so I think that, and this sort of comes back to the last thing I was saying, you know, being back on the same page as the rest of the region, we're seeing the region start to say, hey, you know, this is a problem, and how can we address this? So I don't know exactly what that criteria is, but I know that there's a much more proactive effort to look at that situation.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, you said that the U.S. tries to make this process as chaotic and disruptive as possible and really quick, and Cuba is trying to kind of slow it down a little bit. You said Cuba looks unreasonable because of that. But the U.S. just tried to overthrow, or was instrumental in the overthrow of Maduro. So isn't it very very reasonable of the United of Cuba to not to allow the United States to use civil society to overthrow their government?
So is the question, is Cuba going to allow civil society? I'm sorry. The question, exactly?
The question is, you said that Cuba looks unreasonable because they are trying to keep that process under control.
Mm-hmm.
And In Venezuela is one of the most democratic countries in the world, so you cannot really say that the United States tries to bring democracy to Venezuela, yet they just had a coup attempt, which where there seems to be lots of evidence that the United States was, as in other coup attempts, involved in that. So,
I see your point. I think that the United States had a very different policy towards Latin America in the 70s and 80s than it does now. And at this point, it's really focused on making sure that there's space for civil society, that there's space for dissidents, that there's space for engagement. I mean, if we look at Chile, there's been huge protests in the last year. And, the UN called this a sign of a strong democracy, because strong democracies can support protest and can support dissident movements and can support meaningful engagement. And so I think what the United States is trying to do is make sure that there is that kind of space in Cuba.
Can I insert something? One thing that I would expect to see from these negotiations is to Cuba actually want to take it slow, right? I mean, if we think about the history of U.S.-Cuba relations over the last 50 years, Cuba's policy has been one of resisting, right, U.S. Aggression, resisting and doing, overcoming an embargo, losing its major sponsor in the Soviet Union, and nonetheless, as a point of pride, resisting the United States, right? This is a point of pride for the Cuban government, for the Castro regime, and for many Cubans, right? And so to expect Cuba to give in, right, I think, or not even give in is the wrong word, is sort of to negotiate on the U.S.'s terms is unrealistic,
yeah,
right? And so I think, I mean, what I understood Rachel to say is that the U.S. has every interest diplomatically to make Cuba seem unreasonable, but that's just fine with Cuba, I think. I think they'll take it slow. They're not going to give in to anything they're not ready to give in to, right? And that's just what diplomacy and negotiations are all about, right, is everybody's pushing their own interests.
Right? My name is Chris. I'm a graduate student studying Cuba for my research. I wanted to kind of delve in a little bit, because it seems like with your center being in D.C., you kind of have a pulse on Washington. I want to know, are we beyond the point of return? Is it no turning back? If a Republican president gets to the, president nominee gets to the White House, is the future pretty much in the right direction, even though there may be some specific tweaks? Are we heading in the right direction to get rid of the embargo and to normalize relationships, regardless, according to kind of the political pulse right now in Washington?
Yes. Yes, we really are. I mean, look, I know that a lot of people are very anxious to see some of this legislation come through Congress, because that makes it less and less and less likely that you can turn back the clock, right? So yes, technically, a Republican president could come in and turn back the clock on these policies. It's just not going to happen. I mean, the trend of Americans, of Cuban Americans, of Floridians favoring these changes is just continuing to grow and grow and grow. There's more and more support for this every year. And so no one's going to want to turn back the clock. And frankly, while Cuba has this attention on it right now, that won't last. I mean, by 2017, when the new president will be in office, I mean, this isn't going to last. It just doesn't touch that many people. People will be much more involved in a host of domestic issues or the other brutal and terrifying things we see going on around the world. I mean, there's just so much attention that a country of 11 million people can merit.
Hi, my name is Nathan. I'm a mechanical engineering student here. So you talked about the technology gap and how Cuba's like biotechnology sector is quite prominent,
yeah,
but yet only 5% of the population has internet access. Could you explain, maybe if you know, like why there is such a massive technology gap? Because the biotechnology is a very high tech industry, and yet with only 5% of the population having internet.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is this total disconnect, and I can't fully explain it, but there are a few different things that I think could influence it. One thing is to say that for the biotech industry, Cuba is, they're very proud of the fact that they've found other resources to buy, the raw materials from China and other countries. And as for why there isn't better widespread internet access, like I said, it's a policy decision as much as it is a technical one. So it's a policy decision to be strong in the field of biomedical technology, to be able to use medical diplomacy, as it's called, send their doctors around the world. They sent more doctors to Ebola-stricken countries than any other country in the entire world. So that's in the national interest, just as it's in the national interest to not have everyone connected to the internet.
My name's Daniel. I'm an undeclared student here. And I was just curious, you mentioned that the Castros had outlived 11 presidents now. Very basic question. What's the election process in Cuba?
There's no election.
If any.
There's no election. There just isn't one. Yeah.
I didn't know. Thank you.
My name's Dave. What is the process for picking Raul Castro's successor, and who are the likely successors?
There's no process. It's
they don't have a Politburo.
This is a process.
Right. Yeah, that's the process. You just saw the process, there's nothing open about it. There's nothing democratic about it. There's nothing that's votes on it. I mean, this is a chat between two brothers. There have been a series of people who were sort of appointed to be successors, and one by one they've sort of been pushed out for one reason or another. So there's one hanging around right now. Let's see if he makes it to 2018. Let's see if Raul actually steps down in 2018 as he said he's going to. There's no sort of process to follow, nothing you'll see in the news about primaries or anything.
The one thing to bear in mind is Raul is 70.
Raul is 84.
84.
And Fidel is 87.
There's an interest.
There's
right?
what they call the biological factor
yeah.
in the country.
Very high life expectancy in Cuba. And so there is a, it's an important issue to find a successor. I was just in Cuba with the Utah Study Abroad program as well, and we talked with some journalists and some people, and there's a lot of uncertainty around that. As Rachel said, there's been some people that have been thrown around. What we were told is nobody knows except Raul, right? And maybe even Raul doesn't know just yet who the next person will be.
What I would say is I wouldn't be so anxious to see the end of Raul. This is something that I heard a lot when I was there that was very interesting. I think we wrongfully have this idea that the Castros will die and communism will come crumbling down and we'll have Starbucks there within the week. Not so fast. I heard from some people in the Catholic Church, some people who are plugged into the political scene, that Raul might actually be the best hope for the moment of implementing economic change. He's got some street cred when it comes to the revolution. No one doubts his commitment to the party, to the cause, to communism. And the next guy's going to have something to prove. The next guy is not going to be a Castro. And so he's going to have to prove his party loyalty, his commitment to the cause. And so he might not be quite as anxious to liberalize the economy or relations that in a way that we've seen more willingness from Raul.
Are the results of the polls available?
Yes, absolutely. If you go to the Atlantic Council website, the poll is online. You can Google Atlantic Council Cuba poll, and it will be the first thing that comes up. So it's really interesting. We also asked people a lot of specific things, whether they were in favor of doing things like selling telecommunications devices, taking Cuba off the U.S. state sponsors of terrorism list. We found huge support for these things, but it's really interesting to see those and compare them with some of the changes that President Obama has implemented because they line up quite closely.
Just really quick here. So Raul Castro is 80-something years old.
84.
It's expected that he's going to do the same thing as Fidel Castro, maybe just say, practically just saying, I'm too old for these, I need to step down. Do you think Jose Ramon Machado Ventura, which is like 50-something, which would be like the younger than Fidel Castro was and Raul to take over and like maybe have new ideas? Or do you think it would be the same thing even though?
So Raul has said that he's going to step down in 2018. Mm-hmm. As for who takes over and what his stance will be, I sort of reckon back to what I was just saying about I would worry that that person has something to prove, and I wouldn't necessarily think that being much younger would necessarily make a difference. Yeah.
You mentioned that the literacy rate was 100%. So what are some of the challenges that the Cuban people are facing, some of the major challenges they're facing in their society?
It's an incredibly poor country. And there's very, very little option for growth, for economic mobility, for changing your life circumstances. It's just not really an option there. There's shortages of different types of food and goods. There's no access to information. There's limited ability to travel, to engage with other countries in commerce. It's just a very, very restricted life, and the life you're born into is the one you're going to have for the most part.
I'll add one more. This is an issue for Cuban people, but also for the Cuban government, is brain drain. One of the consequences of a dual economy is that there's more money to be made in tourism, in cleaning hotel bedrooms, in being a bartender, in driving a taxi, than there are in becoming a doctor or pursuing a biotechnology career. And so there's a fear that many of Cuba's youngest and brightest and most entrepreneurial will go into the private sector, which is actually growing really quite rapidly and small. And so cuentapropistas are also waiters, right? That is also a designated category, right? And so people going into the private sector drains skills from core industries that are politically and from a policy perspective very important for the Cuban government, right? So that's something that we've heard a lot about one of the challenges, right? And I think Cuban people see this as an opportunity, but it's also creating in the short term a disequilibrium.
All right, that's all the time we have for questions. Thank you all for being here. Please join me in thanking our guests for this wonderful forum.